Hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann with my co-host and brother Damon Azali. We're very happy to have a guest on the show, DeLacy Davis, who's written, he's a black police officer. He's written a book that we, Damon and I, have both looked at and read, Black Cops Against Police Brutality, BCAP. He's from New Jersey. He's been doing a very difficult job, which, as you can imagine, which is trying to stand up against police brutality inside the police force. I'm sure you've heard many times that, you know, if you join the police force, you're not black, you're blue. So, or you've heard in the South, you know, if you were the police in the South were told blue by day and white by night, which you never will be. So with that context, why don't you start telling us a little bit about your experience? How did you get involved in the police force? What was your initial consciousness? Did you come in with a civil rights, anti-racist consciousness? Was that something that developed out of your direct experience? And welcome to the show.
Thank you, first of all, and peace to the family. I'd like to say I think that I came onto the police force unconscious in terms of where I am today, 20 years later. But more importantly, I certainly was against racism from the very day I know being in the world. In terms of the police department, I joined the police force to finance my music career. No other reason. Didn't join to help anybody. I was looking to help myself. I needed to finance a music career, which I have a very good music career now. And so that was the purpose. It was simply a stepping stone. But about 5 or 6 years into my career, I simply fell in love with African people. I fell in love with humanity, and I fell in love with fighting for human rights. And as a result, it propelled me into 1991 founding Black Cops Against Police Brutality. Nothing had happened to me. I had a good career. I'm a college grad. I was on a fast track in the police department, and it was the founding of that organization that actually brought my career to a screeching halt, as one would understand it, in the police force. And it led me to the premise that I've maintained, which has caused me to be put out of the union once or twice, and I've had to sue to get back in. But my argument has been that the organizational culture of law enforcement is white male dominated, racist, sexist, homophobic, and then you might find a good cop.
Well, with that overview brilliantly said, with which we would agree, tell us a little bit about just your fight to survive. Like, are you presently on active duty in a police force today?
I'm presently an active police officer. I'm out on an extended sick leave since this past April. They're attempting, I believe, to fire me, and certainly because they've not had any other vehicle to use. What they've most recently sent me to a fitness for duty exam where their doctor said he believed I was not fit, and they now have ordered me to a psych evaluation. Which is fine by me, because certainly if there's anything wrong with me emotionally or psychologically, then the damage was done as a result of me spending 20 years inside of the belly of the beast. And that's okay. DeLacy Davis has done 20 years, and that is sufficient. I think one of the difficulties, and it says this in supervisory manuals when you study for promotion, that police officers who are educated, who go on to higher education, are usually those who become frustrated within the system. And there's some truth to that. And the frustration is you realize that the game you've been playing doesn't really work, that you've taken an oath to protect and serve the people, and you find yourself oppressing people. You find yourself questioning things that seem to be logical. Like, I began to ask simple questions like, how is it that a guy that comes to work drunk every day in uniform locks up a citizen for drunk driving? And those were real questions, because I'm looking at my white supervisors drunk every day. I could smell the alcohol. And so I just asked one day, I said, well, doesn't he think he should lock himself up first or just let every drunk go free? I mean, it just made sense. Now, I was young and naive. I'm 24, 25 years old on the job, and it just made sense to me. Or if you saw a guy smoking a half a joint or a quarter of a joint, well, the time you spent doing all this paperwork and clearing him, locking him up and giving him a criminal history, why don't you just let him throw the joint away and give him a warning the first time, or eat it. I don't care what he did, but it just defied logic for me.
DeLacy, let me move to a couple of, you're doing great. One of the questions we want to know is this. Tell us, in reading your book, A Crisis Action Plan by DeLacy Davis, Black Cops Against Police Brutality, I didn't get enough of a sense of the actual organizing work you're doing. I know that anybody who's a whistleblower, anybody, especially a black person inside a racist institution, it's a miracle you've lasted 20 years. But give me an example of a specific case of police brutality you found. What was your tactical plan? What did you do, and what was the outcome?
A simple case. I can think of an instance with an officer, who actually knocked someone's teeth out in the city of East Orange, and we testified against him. We contacted the victims. We told them we would testify on their behalf. We went into court. We gave testimony. The victim was found not guilty of the charges that were concocted against him. Charges were brought against the officer, and they were sustained as a result of that. And essentially, in the book, what we try to do is give you the how-to go about the process, because it's going to change based upon the case and where a particular individual may be. But that's the process start to finish.
Now, the question is, because the book does go into a lot of how-to, but I want to stay on how do you do it. So the question is, was there a sustained movement? Did you pick up a lot of people? Did you lose people? How big are you now? Is your organization still viable, growing, hanging by a thread?
Well, let me say this. One, I don't give out numbers solely because when we give the numbers and they count the people in the
sure,
body.
Sure, of course.
Certainly, we work in 18 different states around the country. We partner and build. We have coalitions all around the country. Certainly, we've picked up a lot of people and we've lost some people. Some of the people that we've lost are some officers and some community people. Some of them cannot stand the pressure. I will say to you candidly, this most recent battle that I'm in, and it's a war. I mean, we're in court, in federal court with my own agency, and most of the officers around me have fallen off because they cannot withstand the pressure that the system brings to bear on them. However, we've been successful, and it has grown from police brutality to police misconduct and simply justice. I guess one of the biggest cases we've worked on in the last couple of years was the Lionel Tate case. That's the 12-year-old in Florida did the wrestling move, killed a little girl, and got life with no parole. And while we believed he should be punished, we didn't believe a 12-year-old
was
sentenced to life with no parole. As a result of the action plan, his mom had contacted us by way of someone that had arrested for drugs from years ago. We flew to Florida. We organized. We spent 3 years working. And on January 24, 2004, I walked him out of a state prison in Florida to freedom. Now, it took us 3 years to do that. That is a process, and there were 34 people that started with us, and by the time we got to the end, we were down to about 5 or 6 people.
Well, first of all, as an organizer, Damon and I can both tell you that, unfortunately, at this point in history, that is more the case than not. That is to say, the brave and courageous stick it out to the end, and other people maybe ride part of the way with you.
That's right.
The question I'd ask is this. Have you thought about more collective class action, systemic charges? In other words, it sounds like you've done excellent intervention on specific cases, and I can tell you're a fighter and a very creative tactician. But the question is, given how widespread it is, have you engaged in an effort to change a policy, to say that, to change a policy either through political action or through class action legal suits?
We've done a variety of those things. For example, in New Haven, Connecticut, the Malik Jones case, which I cite in the book in 97, who was killed, shot 19 times by the police on a motor vehicle stop in New Haven, Connecticut, unarmed. As a result of working with the Malik organization, his mother, Emma Jones, who writes in the second chapter, we were able to get policy change and laws changed in the state of Connecticut. In Connecticut now, they have the Malik rule. When someone stops on a motor vehicle stop, it all has to be documented, start to finish. Probable cause has to be sustained, or at least reasonable suspicion. In addition to that, there's an anti-racial profiling law on the books in Connecticut. So in that instance, yes, there was policy change. There was sustained changes there. In addition to that, we partnered with his mother. She filed a civil rights lawsuit, and it was a pattern and practice lawsuit, which she won. Now, it's an appeal and has been for the last 3 years, but she won. She asked for no money damages, and an all-white jury awarded her $2.5 million. So those are some of the different approaches that we have taken, and certainly in New Jersey, we've signed on at various times to build, to bring lawsuits against the state relative to racial profiling with the American Civil Liberties Union. So we have done that at times, but I think that there are organizations that do that all the time, and you should do what you're good at. So we sign on when we can sign on organizationally, but we're best active and effective at the grassroots level.
Sounds good. I mean, one of the things I want to ask you about is the role of black police. When I was in, to date myself, 1965, was organizing a protest in Washington, D.C., in front of Lyndon Johnson's church, calling, you know, involved in anti-war activity, saying that Lyndon Johnson was a war criminal. Probably today I'd be under the Patriot Act,
absolutely,
deep under, you know, ground. But at this point, they still had a few things called civil liberties, and I was allowed to do it. I became friendly with a black officer who was paid to guard the church, you know, guard the president. As we talked, he befriended me and confided in me as I came every Sunday, and started telling about the pressure who he was under inside the force in D.C., that one of the things happening with black officers is the first test of their loyalty was to beat up black prisoners. And he would be sent to beat up black prisoners. They would give him a kind of a rubber club that would not leave a mark. And if he didn't beat up a black prisoner, then the white police said, see, you're really black, you know. You know, you're not a real policeman. And he was terrified of it. He was going through terrible psychic damage. Now, 40 years later, what is the issue with the growing number of police that we've won, in black police inside a lot of these forces? What is the culture, the dominant culture of the black police today? Are they more progressive as a group? Or does it take somebody like you to try to change the consciousness of the mainstream black policeman?
I think that it's not as simple as that. I think there are some complexities there. Certainly there are progressive black police officers around the country. I've worked with some. I was the regional president for the National Black Police Association for 4 years, representing about 10 chapters in 46 chapters in 8 different states. And so I know that they're progressive police officers. But they're also what I call the Negroes, who suffer from what I call CNS, Confused Negro Syndrome. Black people in positions of authority more concerned with doing a white thing than doing the right thing. And those officers are also pervasive, and it is those officers that get promoted, and those officers who do what they have to do to make rank, and it becomes a challenge. I think the state of black policing in America today in 2006 is that it is dysfunctional. It is probably worse than it was in the 60s, because in 1972 you saw the emergence of the National Black Police Association for the reasons we've just discussed.
That's right.
And here we are in 2006, and we have black police organizations where we don't speak at all. And the reason we don't speak, because the Lacey Davis, I know, is told things like, well, your organization is too radical, and you are too black, and you're going to get all of us in trouble, and why do you have to speak so loudly, and why can't you just give a little of your grant money away? It's the cost of doing business. And what I say to them is that we are becoming just like the thing we said we would fight.
Absolutely.
Sergeant David, you sound a lot like what we get when we're out doing organizing work. You know, you guys are too radical, you talk about race too much, et cetera, et cetera. So keep fighting on that. One of the things that I saw wasn't in your book, or it could have been in your book, but I saw it on your website, was talking about dismantling the organizational culture of the police department, which you said was racist, sexist, homophobic.
Yeah.
I would go a little further, and you would probably agree with me, I would imagine, that if you just talk about the roots of the police department and policing in this country, it comes out of slave patrols, it comes out of a very convoluted structural racism that is still prevalent today.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that you were saying is one of your goals is to actually to dismantle it, to take it apart. And I think that that's a really interesting question I would like to ask you. If you're taking that apart fundamentally, what do you replace that with? What do you have that people in the community actually feel safe but aren't brutalized over it?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I think it changes by community, and certainly the power belongs to the people, and the people determine ultimately how they are going to be governed in a particular community. However, I can speak about my specific community. My community has rallied against this city, this mayor, and this police department on numerous occasions, 400, 500, 600 people, parents and children, to say, this is the kind of policing that we want, and you take up the Lacey Davis out of community services. Ironically, it was a Caucasian chief who I was in disagreement with most of the time who decided to create a position for me, which was called community services, allow me to command it. He took it from 40 officers down to 2 and said, since you've been so critical of community policing and of the police department, you will now have to practice what you preach. You have 2 weeks to have this office up and running. And it was a great challenge. The blessing was that we reduced juvenile crime over a 5-year period by 51%. We took the East Orange Police Athletic League, which is where I'm sitting today, in a building that we just bought April 18th of last year, an abandoned building, 16 rooms, 3 stories, got a $200,000 grant, and here we are in our own home that belongs to the community in the hood, and it's glorious. And what we've done is We went from 150 children in 7 programs to 2,600 children in 18 programs, and we empowered them. Young people right now, as you hear them moving around the building, are running this building. They're answering the phones. They're running the desk. They're on the computers. They're doing homework. This belongs to the community, and our community has said this is the kind of policing that we want. We want a building. We want an officer that our children are not afraid of, that is going to have a standard for them. I've raised 3 children from this community and adopted the most recent one, a 14-year-old girl who's now 17, went from straight F's to straight A's, coming out of a group home for 10 years. And we know it works. These are the things that we practice, they've tried and proven. And what I often say to my staff and to other officers, especially in black communities, are you kid tested? See, it is easy for you to take your gun and badge and say you are the police and we should listen to you. But are you willing to take your gun off and go into the community where they don't like the police and let them know that you're unarmed and you're at their mercy? You know, one of the questions you asked earlier, I remember going into the Lawrence Myers shooting, which I talk about in the book, in Paterson, New Jersey. That city burned for 3 days after a white police officer shot him in the back of the head, 16-year-old, unarmed. They called me into the community. I was loaned to them for 6 weeks. But I went, I promised the young people that I would never come in their midst with a gun on. If they would promise me, they simply would listen and we would try to work toward a solution that was in the interest of the community. And I continue to go into the so-called projects to do free services for those young people. And I've done that since the early 90s with my team, with our staff, and we do it around the country. That is how many communities, especially the poor black communities, want to be police. Yes, they want police. We don't want lawlessness. They don't want people jumping out of trees, robbing you, killing each other. But they don't want to be abused and oppressed either. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both and.
Well, DeLacy, Sergeant DeLacy Davis, we'd like to thank you for being on the show. You guys can get more information about Black Cops Against Police Brutality at www.b-cap.org. Encourage you to check out the book. Definitely great how-to guide on how to fight back against police brutality and organize around it. So thank you, Sergeant DeLacy Davis, and we'll be right back with Kathy Fing.
Thank you for having me. Somewhere.